Shelley Winter's film career has spanned more than 40 years. She first was packaged as a blonde bombshell by Universal Studios. The role, though, that established her as a serious actress was in George Stevens' 1951 film A Place in the Sun, where Winter starred opposite Montgomery Clift and Elizabeth Taylor. She was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Actress. After making many second-rate films and weathering a failed marriage during the early 50s, Winters left Hollywood and moved to New York, where she was involved with the Actors Studio, working with Lee Strasberg and Elia Kazan, also with Marlon Brando and Paul Newman. In 1955, she first appeared on Broadway in A Hat Full of Rain, a pioneering play about drug addiction. She continued her film career and won two Academy Awards, one for her performance in The Diary of Anne Frank, the other with Sidney Poitier in A Patch of Blue. More recently, she's been in The Poseidon Adventure and Roger Corman's Bloody Mama. Shelley Winters has just published the second part of her autobiography, Shelley II, The Middle of My Century. In it, she details her career and her three marriages and many affairs with stars such as Marlon Brando and Burt Lancaster. Throughout her career, she's been known for her one-liners and her outspokenness. She's described it as a need to invent an identity as she goes, making herself larger than life. I ask Shelley Winters if she still feels this need to create a persona.
Sometimes. I hope I've gotten over that. Not off-screen, on-screen. And off-screen in terms of publicity. You know, this book is called Middle of My Century, Shelley II, and I go from, ostensibly 54 to 64, but I go back to the late 40s when Marilyn Monroe and I lived together. And both of us knew that, you know, they photograph you, they put it in a can, they rent the can, and we... In those days, pre-Women's Lib, what was selling was, I don't know what you're allowed to say. Is this a morning show? Well, we knew that what was acceptable were the tits and ass girls with the platinum blonde hair. And we said, okay, that's what they want. Let's think of things that fall into that category. And she was really much smarter than anybody ever gave her credit for. She read a great deal. And she would say things like, if somebody said, "What do you have on when you sleep?" She'd say, "Chanel number 5." What do you have on?" She'd say, "Well, the radio." So we got very good at making up these blonde bombshell things. And it is a persona. It is not a person. It still haunts me. I think. Especially on Johnny Carson for a while. I was a middle-aged blonde bombshell, and now I'm a senior citizen blonde bombshell. Sometimes. But I tried to get away from that.
One of your lines, one of your witticisms was, "I'm the modern independent type woman." In other words, a girl who can't get a man.
I don't...
Speaking of things that come back to haunt you.
Yes, that's why.
Years later.
Yes, I must have been mad when I said that. One of the greatest compliments I ever got was from Betty Friedan. Gloria Steinem said that the films that I fought for and got, like Double Life, A Place in the Sun, Night of the Hunter, women who were victims, that in my way I was preparing the ground for the Women's Lib movement because I was showing the public, the victims that women were, and they had a fight against being pushed into these categories. And I hope I did that. That was a great compliment.
Well, the film A Place in the Sun was directed by George Stevens, based on the Theodore Dreiser book, An American Tragedy. And,
yes.
And your role in there as Alice Tripp, you were nominated for Best Actress in 1951.
I know. It was very early in my career, and I was very proud of it. And when you realize now that the girl had no option, she went to see this doctor and hoped that he would help her with an abortion, because certainly Monty Clift, who was involved with Elizabeth Taylor and up there with the son and the successful and rich people, didn't want to marry her, and she couldn't go home. They would kick her out. And there was nothing for her to do, and she ended up dead. And... It's a kind of example of what the morality and the innocence and ignorance of this girl, and I guess Dreiser was a great writer, realized that was one of the greatest problems of the American society, both at that time, and I think it exists now.
How did George Stevens direct you for that role? You'd written that he taught you to think.
He's a great director. He was the greatest that I ever had. You know, you learn words, and then you say the words. But he taught me that words are a result of thinking, as in real life. And that's why actors must improvise, not say the writer's words. They must think the things and say the things that are close, but are not really the writer's words. And then finally you get to those words through your thinking process. And often what goes on between two actors in the silence is more powerful than the moments one or other actor says. George directed silent pictures, and he felt that sound ruined films.
One of the most powerful scenes in A Place in the Sun, of several powerful scenes, is done without words. It's a silent scene in which you're waiting to hear from Montgomery Clift, who's up away at a summer place with Elizabeth Taylor, and you're hoping for a letter. And you come out to a mailbox.
Oh, thank you for remembering that. Stevens created it. I didn't know we were going to do that. And I was 2 or 3 months pregnant, and I thought that, you know, I knew that he was related distantly to the people who owned the factory that I worked in. And I know he's visiting a cousin, and I'm waiting for a letter from him because I'm so absolutely scared and, terrified. And I come out to the mailbox, and I'm sort of nauseous, and I think I will get a letter. And there's the weekly newspaper of that neighborhood, and there's a picture of Monty Cliff motorboating with Elizabeth Taylor, and it's like a Greek tragedy. I look at it, and I know my fate is doomed. I know, given the values of being up there with the people in the sun and in the rich, that it's I don't know whether he will have the moral fiber, and I'm pretty sure he won't, to reject that and marry me.
How did the scene come about?
He had it in his head. George Stevens, for instance, he taught me something about acting that I've remembered forever. In the scene with country doctor, when Monty takes me there and asks me to tell the doctor to help, I sat there and we did the scene, there was dialogue, and I cried for 9 minutes, you know, blew my nose, a tear streaming down my face, and we did the scene. And then, directors can't do this now. And after it was over, he said, print. Okay, he said, we're going to see that, Shelley, you'll see it. And then I thought, that man is crazy. I was marvelous. I was fantastic. I cried through the whole scene. And he said, now I want you to do this. He said, no, he asked me. He said, if you came to see this country doctor and he suspected that you were asking him to perform an illegal abortion, what would he do, Shelley? And I had to be truthful and say he would become very frightened and get rid of me. I mean, I didn't want to say that, but I had to. So, when I did that, there's a scene that I had to do it again, and I never cried. He said, play with your handkerchief, play with the things on his desk, and all that. And we did it again, and I didn't cry. And for 35 years, I guess, and they play Place in the Sun every August in a theater in Venice, and in every audience, women weep, and the men in the audience go, oh, like that. And he taught me a great lesson. My job isn't to cry, it's to make the audience cry.
There's a scene I'd like for us to hear from A Place in the Sun, where you and Montgomery Clift, you have decided to confront young George Eastman to force him to marry you, even though you know it's desperate.
You're going to marry me tomorrow. I'll telephone the newspapers and tell them everything, and then I'll kill myself.
Don't talk.
You make me talk like that. Now, we'll go to Warsaw in the morning and get married.
Get out of here.
I won't get out of here until you say you will. That you're going to do it.
All right, come on.
What were the inner resources that you drew upon to do that scene?
Well, George Stevens is such a great director, and he would find very personal things in you that were similar. And in this instance, this girl knows that she's probably facing death, or if not terrible disgrace, if this boy doesn't marry her. And he would sort of talk about my own personal life. When I did A Place in the Sun, I had been married to a soldier. We had gotten married, you know, right after Pearl Harbor. There was a kind of realization that we did not know each other, and I knew the marriage was over, and I was desperate to make the marriage work. And somehow George Stevens got to know me very well and my history, and he would talk about that until the kind of desperate, angry, fatalistic, hopeless thing came out. Good directors always use things that have happened to you, kind of traumas, which they make you recall by the sensory things. When we did Diary of Anne Frank, he would make the attic in the summer turn up the air conditioning till we all had terrible colds, and in the winter months, but make it so hot we couldn't bear it. And through the sensory memories of that special trauma that you remember, you recall it exactly. That's one of the very important things about acting, and good directors know it. And it was a lot of pain, but it was worth it. I had a terrible reaction when I saw the film all cut and put together, and Charlie Chaplin, who was a friend of Stevens, was there, and Theodore Dreiser's widow, and some other intellectual, wonderful people. And when I saw kind of a rough cut of the movie, I hadn't realized how naked he had made me from scene to scene. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Naked.
Mm-hmm.
And when I saw the picture, I turned around to him and said, "Don't talk to me again as long as you live." And I ran out of the projection room, and the police wouldn't, and Paramount wouldn't let me drive. The one took me home. And what it reminds me of is some Og de Cabot once asked Lynn Fontanne, "What do you think of the new nudity that's off Broadway and on Broadway?" And she looked at him and she said, "I don't understand. Good actors have always been naked."
In looking back over your film career, I've seen that you've played a variety of whores and madams and mothers.
Well, maybe there's something of mother in those characters. The ones that I'm proudest of is Lolita.
In the Stanley Kubrick film?
Yes. Uh-huh. And I don't know whether I did whores that I'm especially proud of. I guess the mother in Patch of Blue, who's... you know, has a blind daughter, and she's bigoted and a racist, and it was very difficult to do that, but I did it, and I got an Oscar for it. But you know, actors want to be sympathetic. It's very hard to play characters that are mean and hateful, and there are people like that. I always kid Richard Widmark and say, "You threw an old lady in a wheelchair down the steps and you got an Oscar, and that was the most famous thing in your career." He gets rather annoyed, but it's true. When the audience is shocked that way and they recognize there are people like that and maybe something like that in themselves that we suppress, they recognize it on the screen. You got any other special whores and hookers and madams in mind? Let me see. I've done a lot, I know.
I've also noticed that you often get killed off in the pictures. Stabbed, drowned, heart attack,
because especially
strangled.
In this section of my book, which I call The Middle of My Century, I was going to call it The Best of Times, The Worst of Times, but Charles Dickens had that before me. And so because it's sort of the middle of my career, and I did do a lot of films like that because there was the code then, and if you did something immoral, you had to be killed off. That was one of the rules of the code. As a matter of fact, one of the first pictures I did with Ronald Coleman, we made love, and George Cukor, one of the the implications of a sexual murder. He was reenacting a double life that he was a Ronald Coleman was doing Othello. And they came down from the code to look at. They said, as long as you saw one of his feet on the floor, even though we were on a bed, it was okay if he strangled me that way. And I thought that was one of the silliest rules I had ever. Yeah.
Right. There was a time after the assassination of Robert Kennedy when you decided that you didn't want to do violent movies, and in fact you were involved in one at the time because you were objecting to the idea of gratuitous violence in films. Was that something you still feel, have felt since 1968?
Very much. I tried to organize a thing about gun control in, I think I was doing a, maybe, when was he killed, 68?
Mm-hmm.
I was doing a film called Bloody Mama, which was about a gangster lady in you know, Ma Barker, and it was almost kind of funny in a way, and I tried to get out of it, and I couldn't.
What do you feel, then, has been the most effective aspect of your career? Has it been a political influence? Has it been some of your characters that have perhaps moved people in one way or another, such as in A Place in the Sun, as a comedian, as a talk show personality?
Well, that's a difficult thing to answer. When I get a case of the dooms in the middle of the night, it was very difficult for me when I went to school. I really wanted to be a lawyer and perhaps go into politics, but women didn't do that. And the only place I had to study was under the roof. I'm just making excuses, I guess, and I was enchanted by the glamour and the money and stuff like that. And I've tried through the plays. I did the first anti-drug play, which was a big success, Hatful of Rain in 55. And I've tried very much in the things I pick to do things which I think educate and not only enjoy. You know, you're in a very powerful position when you're an actor. Like, I love doing Two for the Seesaw because it's about a man and a woman. And although it's not a happy ending, the relationship prepares them for, especially the woman, for another kind of relationship. That even though it's a sad ending for them, somehow they change during the relationship, so they'll be more open to more mature and happier and better relationships. I've tried to do that kind of thing.
You've been asked many times to put on weight for movies. George Stevens
wanted
yes. to do that too.
It's a terrible problem in my life. The first time was Diary of Anne Frank in order to look older. I was about 33 and I played a woman about 53. And it worked. You know, weight makes you look older. And then I did it for a couple of pictures. One I remember most is Poseidon. He wanted me 200 pounds and I got a nomination. And did I win the Oscar? No, I didn't. Then I did one recently called Delta Force. I'm not going to do it anymore because last year, or a year and a half ago, I lost 50 pounds and then I put back 51. Food is my monkey. I really love food. I don't drink. I don't smoke. I can go away to a spa or someplace like that and I'll lose the weight. And then when I get back in normal society, there I am. It's very hard to say, no, I won't have that. I'm going to have a salad and a piece of fish or something like that.
My guest today is the actress and author, Shelley Winters. There's a scene in your book. You recount the story of one of your husbands, Tony Franciosa, helping you learn some lines for a play. The phone rings. You go to the phone. It's Lauren Bacall. And she says, "Where's Tony? He's late for a date with me." And you say, "You have a date with my husband?" And she says, "If he doesn't respect your marriage, why should I?" And you say, "Okay, I'll send him along with a damaged head." And you tell him to go on and make the date and move on to Los Angeles. Now, it occurred to me that women who are movie stars behave in a slightly different way than the rest of the world.
Oh, I bet that happens more than you think. The whole issue of monogamy is changing in our world, I think. You know, Tony and I would leave each other for long periods doing, plays or pictures, and it's very difficult. There's the competitive factor, and you're When you say one of my husbands, I haven't had that many. I had one during the war that was annulled, and then I had two others. Well, maybe that's more than most people. But I felt that she was saying the right thing. You know, it was absolutely the right thing. If Tony was making a date with her, why shouldn't she make a date with him? I mean, he has. If he didn't respect his marriage vows, why should she? And I have felt that way. I have occasionally dated a married man, and I felt, well, you know. But I think in the years, you know, there's been a... I think my first book made a lot of men, including Johnny Carson, angry with me. I was breaking a code that men had imposed on women for centuries. I think that the whole idea, well, I'm going to be silent, so this man is protected. I think that's a wrong idea. I do.
Well, I want to thank you very much for coming in and being a guest today on Fresh Air with
thank
us.
Thank you. It was very interesting and different. And thank you for respecting my intelligence and my work.
Thank you.